Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. Caroline's not with us today, but check back in future weeks and she'll be back on the air with us. Our guest today is Jasmine Darznik. And this, you know, those of you who've listened to this program for a while know that we love historical fiction, historical novels. And I gotta say, this one not only really grabbed me, but it's different in some sense, and I hope we can get into that, than from any that I've done before, any that I've read before. The author, Jasmine Darznik, had her debut novel, Song of a Captive Bird, become a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice, a Los Angeles Times bestseller, and a winner of several prizes. Darznik is also the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Good Daughter, a memoir of my mother's hidden life. Her books have been published in 17 countries. She was born in Tehran, Iran, and came to America when she was 5 years old. Jasmine holds an MFA in fiction from Bennington College, a JD from the University of California, and a PhD in English from Princeton University, and she must enjoy being a student. But now she's a professor of English and creative writing at California College of the Arts. She lives in the San Francisco Bay Area with her family. And I've got to say, Jasmine, from your picture, you look way too young to have done all of this.
Thank you, I guess.
Welcome to Writers' Voices.
Thank you so much. Really happy to be here. Excited to talk with you.
Oh, great. So the title of the book that we're talking about today is The Bohemians. And this was released earlier this year, 2021. And tell us a little bit about what it's about.
Sure. So The Bohemians is a novel about the great photographer Dorothea Lange, who people might know from her iconic photograph, Migrant Mother, she took during the Depression. She actually came to San Francisco. What a lot of people don't know, and I didn't know, was that she came to San Francisco as a young woman, and she was a bohemian in San Francisco in the 1920s. So the novel traces her coming of age, her friendship with her Chinese American assistant, and it's a love letter also to San Francisco.
And what exactly is a bohemian?
It's a funny term because it has been used in so many different eras and contexts and places, but a bohemian, as I would sum it up, is a kind of counterculture figure devoted to the arts, maybe an artist, but definitely devoted to arts and culture. Somebody who lives maybe a little bit on the edge with not so much money, but high ideals.
Okay. Now, many times historical novels are centered around a real life character, which in this case is true, but I understand that's not where the inspiration of this book began.
Right. So I really started, for me, stories start with place, and I knew I wanted to write about San Francisco, and I discovered this place called Monkey Block, and that was probably really where it all started for me. Monkey Block is short for Montgomery Block, which was this artist colony that stood where the Transamerica building is now in San Francisco, so right in downtown San Francisco. And it's a place that even San Franciscans don't know about. It was for many years a place of kind of bohemian elegance and shenanigans. It was home to a lot of artists and writers. Mark Twain had lived there. Diego Rivera stopped by in the 30s. Some 800 artists and writers had lived there over the course of about a century. So that was, like I say, it was really learning about that building. And then I started casting around for people whose lives had intersected in some way with that scene, with Monkey Block and the bohemian circle around it. And Dorothea Lange was one of them. She landed in San Francisco and was pretty quickly absorbed into that artistic scene centered around Monkey Block.
Now, when is this book set?
It's set in the 1920s. It's pretty much 1918 to 1920.
Okay. And what was it about Dorothea Lange that made you decide, yes, this is the person that I want to center this book around? Because obviously when you write a book like this, you're spending a lot of time with this character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think it's important, at least for me, it's important to feel like in telling someone's story, I can give you maybe an angle or a period of time or something that no other story, no history book can give you. So people know Lange from the Depression. I didn't know her, and a lot of people don't know her during her younger years when she was a portrait studio photographer. So that was really interesting to me, that there was this whole unknown side to her work, to her personality. And then also the fact that she had had polio as a young child was really interesting to me. I think that went a long way toward making her the artist she was and she became. And she had landed, this is probably critical, you know, two things I think beyond that is, one, that she came to San Francisco and was robbed immediately. She manages within a year and a half to become the most sought after studio photographer in the city. That seemed to me pretty fascinating. How do you go from having absolutely nothing, not even a penny in your pocket, to being this illustrious photographer? So that was really interesting and hadn't been told. And then the mention of this Chinese-American assistant. So in biographies of Lange, there's mention of her working with a young Chinese-American woman, but she's a real shadowy figure. And I just got really, I got so fascinated in thinking about what would their collaboration have looked like, what would it have been like for these two women from such different worlds to work together at this point in history.
Well, I think that's what I found so fascinating about this book, is that while your main character, the point of view character, is Dorothea Lange, who is a real person that you were able to find out quite a bit about, this Chinese assistant was just as important to the story, and it was something that you had to imagine quite a bit about, because so little was written about her. And that's what I found, why I think this is such a great, great story.
Well, thank you. I think having the two was really fantastic. So there's Lange, like you say, about whom at least, you know, a good deal is known, not everything, but a good amount I could research. But having the freedom then of inventing it, the character is also researched in a different way. So I had to, in imagining the life of this woman who becomes Caroline Lee in the novel, I had to follow the cues of history. So I knew she'd grown up in a mission home, which was a home for girls and young women who were part of the human trafficking that was flourishing in the city then. Learning about that began to give me a sense of at least her backstory, her history, and help me flesh out by my imagination who she might have been.
That, I think the other thing that was so gripping about the Bohemians is the parallels historically between what was going on then, the racism, the nativism, and today. And this must have been, you know, I don't know if you knew that was going to play such a large part in the story when you started. In fact, that's a good question. Did you know that when you started?
I didn't really. Honestly, I was following my characters, and everything that emerges, even these parallels you're talking about, came about from just thinking about who they were and what they would have encountered. So I didn't set out to write necessarily about white nationalism, but you couldn't not see it when you looked at the newspapers of the time, the treatment of the Chinese in the city. San Francisco was a segregated city. A lot of this I didn't even know. Even though I'd grown up in the San Francisco Bay Area, I was learning this history for the first time. So it was not intentional in the sense that I set out to do this, but it was really just, you know, thinking a lot about all the facets of these characters' lives, the world in which they became who they were. And like I say, it didn't take long to begin to see the contours and shapes of history there.
There's so much of history that we forget or don't know or never taught. And of course, in today's, what's going on in the world today, there seem to be people who want to make that even more the case, that we're not taught these things about history. Were you aware of that as you were writing this book? And sometimes I feel like historical fiction can be one of the best ways to convey the true facts of history, even in a fictional setting, to a reader.
I agree. I really do. I personally love to read history, so it's something I do with great pleasure. But I know a lot of people don't necessarily want to pick up a big, heavy tome of history. Mm-hmm. And so I think the novel can be a wonderful way of looking back, learning something. That's probably the allure of historical fiction, is that you're being told hopefully a good story, but you feel like you're learning something, you're discovering maybe new places or times through the novel. I think first and foremost, though, as a novelist, the story is important. So everything else follows from the story. I think forcing a message onto the story can be really deadening to the tale, right? So it's got to work on the level of the story, and then situating it in these bigger histories becomes an added, I don't know, a pleasure or another level of discovery in the novel, but it has to work on the level of story first.
That's a very good point. So I don't want our listeners to get the idea that this is at all a history lesson. It is not. It is a story set in history.
Yeah, a story set in history. That's a great right. way of putting it.
You're listening to Writers' Voices. Our guest today is Jasmine Darznik, author of The Bohemians. Now, why you grew up in San Francisco, I understand. And when did you actually learn about the Monkey Block?
Monkey Block. Pretty late. So I was teaching in the MFA program at University of San Francisco and had a student who was writing a history of the building. So that was probably my first encounter. Though now that I think about it, I had read the Dorothea Lange biography when it came out, the one by Linda Gordon in, I think, 2011 or 12 it came out. And in going back recently and looking at that biography, I see that she mentions Monkey Block. And I see even that I annotated that I had highlighted those sections. You know, it was definitely the seed was there. So when I saw my student's account of this building, it definitely sparked something for me.
Wow. When did the Monkey Block get torn down?
It went down in 1958 or 9, I'm thinking. So this was just before there was a historic preservationist movement in San Francisco. There were a few people who clamored and sought to prevent it from coming down. But the building had really, it kind of had fallen into disrepair. It had started out as this really fancy building, tallest building in the West, and survived the earthquake. So it was a really well-constructed building. But over the years, the more fashionable, the lawyers' offices and the businesses had migrated to different parts of the city, and this building just kind of fell into disrepair. So there was no necessarily feeling like we have to preserve this. Then for 10 years, it was just a parking lot. And eventually in the 60s, it's true. It was actually
a
parking lot. And this is, if you know San Francisco, if you've ever visited or read about San Francisco, this is right at the bottom of Columbus, which is where, that's the Italian section of the city, North Beach. So imagine this enormous parking lot, right? Just sitting there for about a decade, and then the Transamerica Pyramid goes up eventually.
When you say it was the tallest building in the West, it was what, four stories?
It was four stories, but this is the mid this is the mid 1800s. Wow. And it was a real feat of engineering because that part of the city was all water. That was all water, and they filled it in, and the building itself was constructed on redwood logs. They called it Halleck's Folly, actually, because they thought it was such a, you know, kind of fantastically absurd idea to build this, what would have then been enormous tall building on redwood logs, but they did it.
Wow. Wow. It just sounds like it's kind of like Paris in the 20s, isn't it? Like the Left Bank and, you know, that's one of my
really
favorite
is.
Settings for movies or books and feeling like, what would it have been like to have been there?
Yeah, I definitely have that. I've been besotted with the 20s ever since I was a teenager. And when I was growing up, I would trek over to North Beach, and it was the closest I could get to Paris, you know, as a teenager growing up in the Bay Area. And funnily enough, as I was researching this book, I realized that the San Franciscan Bohemians were very much styling themselves after the Bohemians of Europe, of Paris and Greenwich Village later. So there was a connection even they were aware of and were manipulating in fashioning their kind of Latin quarter of San Francisco.
You must love, like I do, the movie Midnight in Paris.
I do.
Yeah.
I do. It's such fun. But, you know, it's really terrific in that, you know, every character, everywhere I looked when I looked at San Francisco at the turn of the 20th century, those early years, the 1920s, there were characters. I mean, it felt like the whole city was populated by these larger-than-life characters. So it was such fun to definitely to draw on people's fascination with the 20s, but also point to this other bohemian scene that was populated with characters as vivid and wild as anything Paris had seen.
That is a very good point. Let's talk about some of the other characters who make appearances in your book. Do you have a favorite?
Oh, I love them all so much. And I feel like they each one could have been the subject of a novel.
And maybe Oscar Wilde will.
Yeah. There's this line, Oscar Wilde came to San Francisco when he toured America in the 1880s. And he said, it seems like everybody who gets lost washes up in San Francisco. I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but these characters came from other places and invented themselves in such ingenious and kind of fabulous ways. So they really are fantastic. A few that stick out in my mind, Maynard Dixon, who becomes Dorothea Lange, her real life husband. And in the novel, they marry. The novel is really about their early years together. He was a phenomenal character. He'd wear cowboy hats and black capes and walk with a cane down Columbus Avenue with, you know, canvases under his arm. And, you know, he was a pretty, you know, splendid character to write. Also a really gifted artist as well. People don't know maybe his work as well, but incredible personality and really phenomenal artist.
But not much of a husband though.
Not much of a husband. They are not often good husbands, are they? yeah. It's so true. You know, it really is. But he truly was so captivating to a young Dorothea Lange. She was really, really entranced by him, by his aura, by his personality, and by the circle of friends he had. Someone else I really love in the novel is a woman named Consuelo Canaga. And this is also a real person. Dorothea Lange was wowed by her. She was basically doing work that Lange would do 15 years later. She was probably one of the first photojournalists. She was working for the San Francisco Chronicle when Dorothea Lange met her, and she was fearless. She went everywhere in the city and was also an exceptional photographer. So I loved that character. I loved getting to kind of, you know, put Dorothea Lange on the streets of San Francisco with this fearless woman at this time.
I wish someone would write a book about her life, because I imagine it's also very fascinating.
Absolutely. And it's interesting. I mean, I think that now I'm seeing more, of course, it seems like a golden age of the telling of these stories. Women's history has been so neglected. And it's women historians often who are now recovering these stories. And then that becomes a boon for us novelists. We have source material, you know, all of a sudden there's a record and you can play with it or imagine more into it. And so that's been really exciting as a reader myself, but of course also as a novelist to see this renaissance, this blooming of history about women's lives.
So Jasmine, how did you become a historical novelist? You know, your background, you have a law degree, you have, you know, you're a professor. So what was your path to that?
A little, I mean, somewhat circuitous, and I get asked a lot, did you always want to be a writer? I always wrote, and I loved to write more than anything else, but I didn't write stories. I wrote personal essays, and my first book was a memoir. It was a memoir, in a sense, it's a historical novel because it's not about me, so I had to imagine a lot of it. It's the story of my mother and grandmother's life in Iran, starting about 1920. So a lot of the skills I picked up came from that first project, writing a memoir about my family. And I think I just am so, I really like this combination. I love to research, but I also really love to invent. And it's a form that invites both. I find myself really, really just very happily at this intersection between truth and story. And probably, you know, most of all, I really feel such excitement in discovering, as I was talking about, these stories of women from history and bringing them to light and making you maybe curious. I have people tell me when they read Bohemians, they're Googling left and right. They want to know what these characters look like, and they go into these deep dives. And I just love that so much. It's really what I do when I'm writing it. So I love giving people that kind of doorway into the past and setting them loose onto their own explorations.
One of the other characters that is really fascinating is the character that ran the mission home.
Yes.
Let's see. Her name was, I'm trying to get that.
It's Donaldina Cameron.
Yes. Donald, like, what an unusual name.
And definitely.
Do you know if there was any actual link between her and Caroline, or was that part of what you imagined could have been true?
So Donaldina Cameron ran a mission home. I was talking about these earlier. Her home at 920 Sacramento Street would have been one of two in the city. So in the biography of Lang, I knew that Lang's assistant had grown up in a mission home. So it's very possible. It's probably more likely that she would have grown up in that home and not be at the second one that existed in San Francisco. And that was terrific because work has been done there. I have a friend actually who wrote a book called White Devil's Daughter about Donaldina Cameron and her years at the head of that mission home. So I think it's altogether possible, and it was very useful to me that there has been research done into Cameron's life and her legacy there in San Francisco.
What is her, where did she come from and what did she accomplish?
Donaldina Cameron was, she, like many of the characters in the book, was not native to San Francisco. She came as a young child. She did not marry, which probably, you know, I think it was a disappointment in, to her family or perhaps even to herself, but it put her in a situation where she had to work. She had to work for a living. She was a very devoted Presbyterian, and so she went into a life that we'd now probably call it social work. She was young when she came to San Francisco. She ran that mission home for about 30, 40 years. She ran it, and over her tenure, that home gave refuge to between 2,000 and 3,000 girls, women, babies who were victims of sex trafficking.
I kind of see her as the Mother Teresa of her age.
I think she was, I mean, with absolute no disrespect to Mother Teresa, she was so brave because she would go shoulder to shoulder with the San Francisco Vice Squad. So there was a squad of police that were, you know, this was their beat in San Francisco, was the brothels and the vice districts in San Francisco. And she would be right there raiding in these raids on the brothels, rescuing these girls. And in the novel, the scene that I write where she finds Caroline is actually very close to actual raids that she participated in the city. So yes, she has, you know, she had a very generous and gracious spirit, but she was fearless too. And kind of remarkably so when we think of women of that time, she was such a renegade in so
many
ways.
And her participation in those raids is documented?
It is. Yeah,
wow.
It is.
That's great.
It is. And she also, you know, she regularly had threats on her life. The many mornings they'd wake up there and they'd find death threats and sticks of dynamite laid at the door. There were so many people who wanted to see her gone. But she continued her work.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Jasmine Darznik, author of The Bohemians. Now, the San Francisco fire, although it's not during the time period in which the book is set, does actually figure prominently in the early part of the book. And, you know, I think I knew that there was a great fire, but I really had never realized how devastating it was.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, growing up in San Francisco, was this something you always were aware of, or did you learn more as you were writing this book?
Definitely the latter. So we were talking about history, and, you know, I was aware that in 1906, that was the year of the great earthquake and the fires in San Francisco. Of course, growing up in the area, you're always aware there's always the possibility of earthquakes. And I had experienced earthquakes growing up. So it's part of our collective awareness here in this part of California. But reading about it is one thing, and then really imagining your characters living through it is another. So I absolutely was learning so much. The devastation was almost absolute. 4/5 of the city went up in flames, and people were displaced for years, really. The city rallied, and within a decade, it was bright and shiny and new. But it was a critical moment in the city's growth and idea of itself. You came out, I think that generation that came out of the earthquake and fires had a sense of itself as really heroic. You know, they had witnessed their city destroyed, and they had refashioned it with such glory and beauty, so that by 1915, when there's a World's Fair, it's one of the great wondrous cities of the world.
Wow. Well, Jasmine, would you read from The Bohemians for us?
Sure, I'd love to. So I will read from near the beginning. The book is told in first person. This is Dorothea Lange's voice telling the story of her arrival in San Francisco. San Francisco, the jewel city, Paris of the West, a place where everything, absolutely anything, could happen and probably was happening at this very moment. A place you could disappear into if you dared. Here it was. Here I was. I'd grown up close to the water, not far from the Hoboken shipyards, but nothing prepared me for that first glimpse of San Francisco in May 1918. Until that moment, I didn't know everything around the city, sky, land, sea, could make it look so small. But even if San Francisco seemed smaller than I'd pictured, it was still a thing of beauty and wonder, what with the bay and deep green hills encircling it. Also, it wasn't just beautiful. It was foreign to me in a way Manhattan had once been and wasn't anymore. No one here knew me, which meant I could be whoever I wanted to be. When the view disappeared behind factories and rows of cropboard houses, I cracked open my camera case and admired my Graflex, its sleek metal shine, its perfect polished lens. Arnold Genthe had given it to me a few months after I'd started working for him. It was my first camera and by far the best gift anyone had ever given me. "You have an eye, Dorothea," he told me. It always made me smile, remembering that day. Genta's eyes dancing as he held the camera out to me. The moment when I took it in my hands, felt its exquisite weight, and understood that it was mine. The train jerked and tilted and stopped. I made my way down the aisle and onto the platform, half carried by the crowd. I hurried along as fast as I could, as fast as my limp let me. Soon I was in the streets, heading toward the docks, with my bag thumping against my thigh and my heart slamming against my chest. I had on a split skirt that ended at my ankles, a tan Macintosh cinched tightly at my waist, and high buttoned brown boots. The boots could have used a shine, but I was bent on catching the very next ferry out to San Francisco, so that would have to wait for now. The whole business was over so fast. One minute the ferry was rocking softly, easing into the terminal, and the next minute it bumped hard against the piles, jostling the passengers and knocking us into one another. I stumbled and nearly fell, but then a hand grabbed my waist, its hold warm and firm. "Careful there, miss," came a voice from behind me. I twisted around. The man standing there was handsome and beautifully dressed, with a three-piece suit and checkered bow tie, blue eyes and blonde hair, slick with brilliantine. I felt myself staring. It took me a minute, but I came back to myself, straightening up and lifting my chin. When I thanked him, the man winked and gave me the richest smile in all the world. "Well, hello, California," I thought, and felt my cheeks go warm. A few steps from this ferry building, I happened on a bakery. Through the window, I saw a stack of donuts under a glass dome. My stomach gave a twist. The last real meal I'd eaten had been somewhere in Texas. It was only some minutes later, when I'd ordered two donuts and a cup of coffee, that I reached into my pocket and discovered that my wallet had disappeared. I reached inside the other pocket, the one where I always kept my watch, but it, too, was empty. For one wild, dumbstruck moment, I stood completely still, heart kicking against my chest, and then it came to me in a slow seep of understanding. That handsome and beautifully dressed man on the ferry was a thief. In what I'd always count as one of the genuine miracles of my life, I still had my camera, but as for my money, it was all, every dollar of it, gone.
Welcome to California.
I know, and that's a fine how do you do, right?
Oh man, I just felt for her so much. It's like, don't you know you'd never put all the money in one place?
Yeah, I know, and it's true. I had to imagine some of the details, but it's true. She didn't intend to stay in San Francisco. She wanted to keep traveling, and once her money was stolen, she was stuck here, which winds up being maybe her great fortune and definitely ours.
Now, in the book, she is kind of rescued by Caroline, but I expect that that's not something that you were able to document or to find documentation of.
Yeah, I had to make certain leaps here, yeah. Some guesses, educated guesses, but somehow between losing her money and just a few days later, she gets a job, but she was folded into this community. And so I was thinking, how might she have gotten there, right? Because you don't just show up. She didn't know anything about San Francisco, so she couldn't have just said, take me to the bohemian heart of the city. You know, so I just thought, well, it could have happened like this, that she met someone and that someone knew somebody and that's how she became part of this society of bohemians.
And the restaurant where Capas, that seemed
yes.
to be really at the heart of it, didn't it?
It was, and that was a place that it did exist, and it was for a part of its history, it was in Monkey Block. It was a place where you could get arguably the best meal in San Francisco for 25 cents. So the Bohemians loved these Italian dives. This was food, you know, a lot of them hadn't come from places with such glorious food and food that could be had so cheaply. So Coppa's was very popular with the Bohemian set, and sometimes they'd trade a plate of pasta and some oysters for a painting, or you know, they would paint even on the walls of Coppa's. In the end, Coppa's had a glorious mural that had been created by these artists who'd come to eat the glorious food there,
which probably was destroyed when the building was torn down.
It was actually that restaurant was destroyed in the earthquake, and then Coppa's had to rally.
Okay.
Yeah. So unfortunately, all those murals, those beautiful murals, were damaged in a fire in 1906. But Coppa's rallied and set up another establishment, and it was, definitely for until Prohibition, at least, it was a hopping place.
Now, how much did the fact that Dorothea had polio as a child, how much of an impact on her life did that have?
I think it was tremendous. So, it's another one of these things, maybe we read about it in a history book, but when Lange contracted polio at the age of 8, it was a terrifying diagnosis. Many came away permanently disabled from it, and Lange did. Her limp that she, to the end of her life, she walked with a limp. She disguised it pretty well. So there was the physical impediment that came of it. But I think even more than that was psychological, because when she was diagnosed, people were terrified and children were pulled out of school, and she was pulled out of school for a year. She was just bedridden essentially and couldn't go out into the streets at all. And so this is a time when she begins to pull inward, and she probably already had some of these faculties, some of these gifts in her, but being bedridden like that really made her an observer. So that period of time when she's laying in bed, she becomes an artist, really. She's beginning to go inward, to go deeply, to observe everything around her with great care and attention. And scholars of Lange talk about how that's probably why when she's taking those Depression era photographs, like My Great Mother, she's so attuned to outsiders. She's so attuned to physical hardship. All of that, at least in part, I think came from having had polio as a child.
And her father abandoned the family. Was that before or after she had polio?
It was afterwards. So these are the two traumatic events of Lange's life, is she gets polio when she's 8, and then maybe just as traumatic is when her father deserts the family. And Lange is brought up by a single mother, essentially. Her mother goes to work. But as happens with these traumas, there's also growth. She starts to go into New York with her mom. She has a single working mother who can't just leave her on her own. So she takes her into, they go in every day from Hoboken into the city. And Dorothea Lange has to basically, you know, wait for her mom to get to come pick her up. And she spends a lot of time just walking around the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And she, again, you know, these are moments that probably were traumatic, but also went a long way toward making her the artist she became.
It's hard to imagine how difficult it would be for a young woman at that time to say, I'm going to be a photographer.
Yeah.
You know, how did that happen for her? How was she able to make that leap?
It seems to me she was always a very willful, determined person. I think that was just part of her makeup as a person. But she also was working class. She had to support herself. She was a young woman just at the time of World War One when the young men were headed out. So maybe, you know, maybe whatever trajectory would have been expected for her to get married and all of that, it couldn't happen. So she went to work, and she wanted to be a photographer probably from the time she was about 16, 17 years old, before she'd even held a camera, she said. But her family put lots of pressure on her. You've got to be practical. You have to support yourself. So she got a teaching credential. She hated it. The children tormented her. She quit the first day. And so she did the practical thing, but then she fashioned a kind of apprenticeship for herself. I mean, she was really making it up. There was no money to go to school for her. You know, there was none of that. She was really making it up for herself, you know, learning wherever she could. She was apprenticing herself. And so her willfulness, I think, carried her through, and that's how she found her way.
I know. When all of everyone's expectations, all of society is telling you, you have to go into this little box, and yet we had these amazing women, one after another, said, nope, not me.
Yeah. And it's interesting also thinking about how San Francisco was actually a wonderful place for her to get marooned, because there was a circle of women photographers. It was much less established than the photography circles in New York, say, right? Because of the earthquake, in part, the established photography community had been displaced by the earthquake, and it creates this opportunity for women to come in. So when Lane gets there in 1918, Imogen Cunningham is in the city, Consuelo Canaga is there, Alma Levinson is there, Ann Brigman. I mean, it's pretty astonishing how many very accomplished and successful women photographers were working in San Francisco before Lane got there.
You know, I never really thought about this, but it's really coming out in as we're talking that these tragedies like the earthquake, like World War One, created opportunities for women.
Yes, absolutely.
Wow. It's kind of like that there's a Chinese folk tale about whether something's really good or really bad. Are you familiar with that one?
No, tell me.
I don't know the details, but it's sort of like something bad happens, but it turns out to be really, for example, this part of it is this man has a son, and the son mm-hmm. breaks his leg, and he thinks, oh, that's horrible, this is terrible. But then the emperor's soldiers come and take all the young men from the forest, from the village to war, but they don't take him because he has a broken leg. And so the broken leg turned out to mm-hmm. be wonderful. But then something else happens that it turns out to be bad, and then it's good, and then it's bad. It's a really interesting perspective that what you think is bad can sometimes have really good effects, and what you think is good can end up having bad effects.
Yeah, and you don't know.
And you
I
don't
mean, you
know.
Can't know. You can't know. And I think that's it's a good thing to remember right now, because I feel like we're going through one of these periods of it just all has felt so hard, and it has been so hard for so many people these last 2 years during the pandemic. And I suppose reading about these episodes in history, you know, it does invite you to think about what could emerge from this, what could come out on the other side of it. In the novel, I actually tell the story of Ansel Adams. I don't know if you remember this, but Ansel Adams, he's a character in The Bohemians, and he gets the Spanish flu. So this is true. He fell very ill as a teenager. And at that point in his life, he wanted to be a concert pianist. He was already playing around with photography, but he wanted to be a pianist. Well, he falls ill, nearly dies from the flu, but he manages to talk his family into sending him to Yosemite. When he goes to Yosemite, he is, by his account, miraculously healed by being in nature. And this becomes one of the deciding moments for him, where he begins that path toward becoming a photographer and really pledging himself to documenting nature, because he truly did feel that he'd been saved.
Wow. Yeah, he's another, and he and Lang actually were friends.
They were friends. They were friends, and it was fun to imagine what would have that first encounter have looked like. And in the book, they are arguing from the beginning, and they were such strong personalities and had sometimes very opposing views about art and life. And so in the novel, they're quarreling, and it's true in life, they were often quarreling too, but had a lot of admiration for the other's work. So great fun imagining them together.
How were you able to capture the details of life during that time period? You said Story for You begins in Place. So what it was like in this place during that time period? Did you use photographs, pictures, accounts, you know, contemporary accounts, all of the above?
I use everything. I'm really voracious in my research. I'm not methodical, but I am voracious. And what you see in the book is probably the yield I get is maybe 5% of what I find makes its way into the book. So I'm consuming memoirs and letters from the time. I'm looking at photographs from that era. Nowadays, you can go onto YouTube and there's footage of you know, early San Francisco that can also be really wondrous. I get really into kind of quirky details. So I was so interested, for example, in the ways women moved through the city and where they went. So I got for a period of time, I was reading just accounts of department stores in San Francisco, you know, just so much. And I wind up, like I say, I don't use all of it, but what I do find is what does make it in there often just is so vibrant and helps so much to put you in that place. So I search with pleasure and I serve it up with pleasure.
Oh, great. When do you do the research as you're writing, before you're writing? Do you mix it all together?
I begin with research. So I'm probably doing that for only that and maybe sketching out ideas here and there. But mostly I'm just steeping myself in the archive and in whatever materials I can find. I found a lot at the San Francisco Public Library, by the way, which was very, very helpful. Writing that novel was such a great resource to have. And then as I'm going through, it might be that, let's say, when I was writing, there's a chapter set in New Mexico. So I might have to stop there and do a bit more research just to give myself more of a sense of the setting, the characters. And then I jump back in. But I'm probably trying at a certain point to let the story breathe and to step away from the research. When I'm done with a full draft, then I'll go in again with lists of things that I want to investigate further.
When you started writing this, did you know what the actual sort of arc of the story would be?
Not entirely. So I do start with writing a summary of the book. That's what my agent and I will hash out together. I didn't always work like this, but I have for my previous novel, Song of the Captive Bird, and for Bohemians, I worked out a 5-page summary of the book. And that's really helpful because it helps you see, is there a story there, right? Mm. I'm somebody who just loves setting so much, and I love place and detail, and plot comes harder to me. So writing a summary helps me have at least a provisional idea of where I'm headed, right? And you can tell a lot from a summary. You can tell if there's sufficient conflict, let's say. So in that first draft, in that first summary, I had Dory and Caroline solving a murder in Chinatown. That's not what happened in Bohemians. that's not what happened. I mean, I realized as I was writing, I realized that was a little bit, it didn't emerge organically from the characters as they were revealing themselves, right? Mm-hmm. So what happens in the book is truer to who they are and their lives as it was starting to develop before me on the page.
So part of that is the fact that Caroline disappears from history at a certain point. Lang doesn't talk about her in anything that she writes, or you don't really know what happened to her.
Yes, yes. So I knew I was writing toward a disappearance or a rupture. I didn't know exactly how it was going to come about, but I knew here was somebody who for a time was very important to her, and then she's gone. How did that happen?
And that is where you sort of bring in this horrible, horrible racism that's going on there. And you have a character who's fictional, but patterned after a real-life mayor and senator.
Yes, yes. So in California in 1920, the senator from California ran on a campaign whose slogan was "Keep California White." And the rhetoric in the book, he gives a speech in the book, is drawn very closely from James Phelan. That was the senator's name. He was previously mayor of San Francisco. And all of that it's historical fact, but like so much about that time and other times, it's really not known widely. And growing up in California, you do have a sense, I had a sense when I was growing up that all the bad things had happened over there, by which I mean toward the east of us back then. At some other point in history, right? And so it was very sobering and, you know, to tell you the truth, really shocking to learn how much of this white nationalist movement was actually born here in California.
It's so sad to me to know what people had to live through, what they had to endure and suffer. And that there are people who still think that's just fine and that's how other people should be treated. I'm sorry, I just don't get it.
I don't either, and that's probably why I'm attracted to telling stories, is I'm trying to understand better how do we get there. It seems so illogical or unfathomable, but certainly it's not ancient history, right? I mean, the fact that so many people are responding to the novel and seeing the parallels tells me that there's a lot that we just honestly just don't know.
Yeah. So back to, like, as you're writing and you're doing, adding the details at the end, you know, things that you're diving deeper in, how do you know when it's done, when it's enough?
It's never enough. It really is not. It's never enough. I can't remember who said this, but it's said of poetry, a poem is never done, it's just abandoned. And a novel is like that too. It might take longer because it's a mass of words and you can worry them into the next century, really. But at a certain time, I think I start to share it with people. I have one friend with whom I share, probably she sees my work first, even before I send it to my editor, and I'll get her read on it. She might have some ideas that I'll implement. And at that moment, you're starting to give up, I guess, but in a good way. I mean, you're starting to emotionally, you're looking at it now critically. You're thinking about what is the reader's experience. I mean, I have to now shape this in a way that's going to be satisfying for my reader. And you're beginning to let it go. You have to. And you have to trust that the others in the process are going to do right by it and help you carry it toward the finish line. And then it's not yours anymore. It's heartbreaking, but then at a certain point, it's not yours anymore. And what has always helped me is to have another project in mind. So by that time, I'm already starting to think about the next project, and I'm maybe starting even to research. So by the time I've sent the last round of edits, it's probably going to be a month before I hear back from my editor, maybe longer. And so rather than, you know, fussing over the words, which would just be counterproductive at that point, at the manuscript, I mean, I am starting to research again, and I'm starting to fall in love with another time, another time.
So can
place.
You give us
a
hint?
How you get over it.
Can you give us a hint of the next time and place you're going to?
Yeah, I'm writing a novel set in 1930s and 40s Hollywood.
Oh, the golden age of Hollywood.
Yes.
So, you know, you talk about your agent and your editor, but when you first started writing, I'm assuming you didn't have either of those. So
no.
how did you first get published?
I took a creative writing workshop at my local bookstore here in Northern California. It's called Book Passage. And I had a teacher who was very supportive in so many ways. I mean, just in encouraging me to write, first of all. But then she also gave me ideas of where to send things. So I started to send pieces to local publications. I had a few personal essays come out in the Chronicle. And so I started as an essayist with pieces that I was writing for that creative writing workshop. And after a time, I'd written enough where my teacher sort of took me aside and said, "You're writing a book. You need to start thinking about, you know," which is astonishing. I didn't go into that workshop with this ambition. I was really frustrated in a lot of ways, and I wanted a creative outlet. I was working on my PhD in literature, which was rigorous and also very frustrating and not very creative in certain ways. So it was a surprise to me when my teacher told me that, but a delightful surprise. And I took her counsel, which was to start paying attention to the acknowledgement sections in novels that I liked. And I saw, she said, eventually you'll see certain names will start to become familiar to you. And it's a good sign that would be someone who might be interested in your work. So I found my agent that way, by just scouring those acknowledgement sections. She's the only person I queried, which is ridiculously lucky. It's absurd. It really is absurd. But I also had, by that point, I hadn't published so much, but I had something to show her. I had some credits, and it was definitely really helpful in getting her attention. So I'd been sending things out, and then we put together what became a proposal for my first book.
Well, congratulations. And The Bohemians is your third published book?
That's
is that
right.
True. Okay. And,
yeah.
And number four will be out when?
Whenever I'm ready to give up.
Well,
still in love.
Well, thank you, Jasmine. It's been lovely having you with us today.
And oh, my pleasure.
And I want to close with a quote from Dorothea Lange. "One should really use the camera as though tomorrow you'd be stricken blind. To live a visual life is an enormous undertaking, practically unattainable. I have only touched it, just touched it."
Beautiful. Yeah.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.